Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
We knew we were on the verge of something great. We believed in it beyond everything else.
You. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 191, a talk with Faith Newman. Faith is a longtime music executive who got her start while still in college at Def Jam Records in 1987, back when you could count the number of employees on one hand and, as she tells us, fit the whole industry on one plane. But she is most remembered for her time at Columbia Records in A&R, where she discovered and signed a young rapper from Queensbridge who had all of New York City buzzing. She then played a key role in creating that artist's debut album. That rapper, Nas, and the album, Illmatic, would change hip-hop forever. But that's only part of Faith's story. In addition to playing a key early role in Def Jam, she also signed or oversaw albums by the likes of LL Cool J, Slick Rick, Jamiroquai, Big L, and even Miles Davis. She is now the Senior Vice President of A&R and Catalog Development at Reservoir Media, a music publishing company. We talked to Faith at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's LL Cool J's favorite backup singer, Faith Newman. Very happy to have MC Fortune on the show.
Oh, no. No, you didn't. You did your research. Wow. Okay. You took it there.
Yeah. You know, wow. Got to start somewhere.
Yeah, man. That's right at the beginning.
Right.
Right so at the beginning.
This was the group four pack, which I don't That's think right. ever got out of Philly.
No, we were in New York.
This was New York.
This was New York.
Oh,
this
okay.
was 1986. I was a teenager and in college at the time. So, yeah, no, this was definitely New York.
Wow. Did you guys, how many songs did you have?
We did a 2-song demo.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly we just ran around, you know, pretending we were a group and stuff, you know. And we did some backgrounds on the Bigger and Deffer album.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was gonna ask about that. You did the one LL song. But first off, what were your song titles?
Oh my goodness. Wow. I remember one started out Four Pack Girly Crew Doing It Just For You. That was the first line. So I don't, you know what? I honestly don't remember the song titles. I probably blocked it out of my memory.
Did you ever perform?
No.
Never performed.
Mostly, like I said, we just ran around going to shows, you know, going to clubs, you know, kind of more as a posse thing than as a group.
Right.
Yeah.
Were all four of you on the LL song?
I believe, yes, all four of us were on two LL songs. Oh,
so there was Let's Get Ill.
Yeah. And go LL, go LL.
How'd you end up in those sessions? I assume just because you were at Def Jam at the time?
This is before I started Def Jam. Yeah, this is really early because I didn't start Def Jam till 87.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this was way early. How did we get on that? Well, we knew the LA Posse.
Production team, the LA Posse's founding members were Daryl Big Dad Pierce and Dwayne Muffla Simon. Bobby Bobcat Irvin and DJ Pooh were also involved. The crew produced records by LL, The Real Roxanne, Houdini, Breeze, and more.
And, you know, they did the Bigger Deffer album. Mm-hmm. So how we met the LA Posse, I'm not sure, but that was, you know, Daryl and Dwayne and DJ Pooh.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to kind of take care of them. They lived in Brooklyn. They kind of set them up in this place in Brooklyn. Brooklyn was a little different then, you
right.
know. And we used to bring them food and stuff. And you know. Yeah, so we just, that was our crew. That's who we were hanging out with.
Amazing. So, you know, you grew up in Philly, mm-hmm. obviously. And so your first kind of job in the music industry, mm-hmm. I know you grew up a huge music fan and stuff, but yes. was with Electric Factory Concerts.
Concerts as an intern. Yeah. As an intern.
What were you doing for them? Or how'd you get that gig in the first place?
Well, okay. I went to a show at the Mann Music Center. It was a Steel Pulse show.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And I forget who else was playing, but I was big into reggae. Mm-hmm. Like in my junior year of high school, I just got way immersed in reggae, you know. And then, so I, you know, I met this guy, totally innocent, who worked for Electric Factory Concerts. And he, you know, I expressed to him my love for music and my desire to be in the music industry, which I had known I was going to do since I was 14. That was kind of my goal. So he's the one who got me the internship. And it was a small, it was just over the summer and it was, you know, it was brief, but I got to meet a lot of people. I got to be at Marvin Gaye's last concert, Sexual Healing Tour. Which was amazing. And the funny part is, just to take it back a little bit, how I decided I was going to be in the music business was when I was 14. And I went to my first concert, which was the Cars. So I used to love the Cars. And I was very excited to go. My brother, who was 16 at the time, was going to go with me. And so I went to the show and feeling all excited because I had a scrapbook on them and I just love them, you know, and I'm all excited. And I go to the show and I look around. This is at the Spectrum in Philly. And I look around at like the 20,000 people sitting around me. And I got this feeling that came over me that was like, I don't want to be one of these people who sits in a crowd. I want to make things happen. I want to, like, I knew that there had to be people behind concerts and behind radio and behind everything. And that's when I decided that's what I would do with my life. Yeah.
Nice. And one thing I found kind of fascinating that I hadn't really heard you talk about was before you were at Def Jam, mm-hmm. you were, and before, you know, and before you worked at Columbia for real, mm-hmm. you were at Columbia
as an intern.
How did that happen?
I'll shout out my friend Gary Harris. I don't know if you know Gary.
No.
Gary is an amazing guy. Spent a long time in the music business. Does a radio show on Beats with Q-Tip now, mm-hmm. and is a blogger and just an amazing writer. And anyway, at the time when I first moved to New York, I used to model. I had a fashion show that I did at Studio 54. So this was 85. And after the show was over, this guy comes up to me, introduces himself. His name is Steve Kapitko. He was an attorney in the music business because they had asked the girls what we wanted to do, you know, what our goals were and all this stupid stuff. And so I said, I want to be in the music business. So this guy, Steve, came up to talk to me afterwards. And he was, you know, and my mom was with me. So it was, you know, it wasn't, you know, skeevy or anything. And he just offered to, you know, give me advice. And so I ended up going with him to my first music industry party, which was the Billy Ocean's Gold Record Party at the Water Club. That's where I met Gary. And Gary was doing promotion at the time, independent promotion. And, you know, I mean, I would chat up anybody because I had this sense of myself as being, you know how it is when you're like, you know, 19 years old, you have this kind of grandiose vision of yourself. And I was just convinced that I was going to be in the music industry. I just had this, you know, this sense that there would be nothing else that I would do in my life, you know, but that. So he said that he would try to get me an internship at Columbia Records. So this was the spring of 86, and that summer, I used Steve's badge to get into New Music Seminar. That was the place to be.
Right.
You know, so I kind of snuck in. Wow, I even have to take it back further, actually. My freshman year of college, I went to GW because my parents wouldn't let me go to New York, even though I had been sneaking away.
I would say you'd already been to...
I had already been to New York a bunch of times. Yeah. They didn't know that. They thought I was sleeping over at a friend's house. they didn't really know it till recently, actually, that I was taking the Greyhound bus, you know, to Port Authority so that I could go to the Roxy and, you know.
Did they ground you when they found out?
No.
Decades later?
Decades later, right. You know, I'm like 40 and they're like, how dare you? So I was on the concert board at GW. And we did some really interesting concerts. One of them was we did a Herbie Hancock and I think it was a Bad Brains. And I mean, we used to do these incredible kind of mashup shows. And one of the shows that we did was REM when they put out their first record. So REM was signed to London Records. I met a guy who worked for London Records, this guy, Mike Sefton. So when I had kind of, you know, snuck into the new music seminar and was making my rounds, I ran into Mike Sefton and he said, oh, so good to see you. Let's have dinner later. And I said, sure. And I was living at the time on Sullivan Street between Bleecker and West Third. So he came to pick me up and we're walking down Bleecker Street and we get to the corner of Bleecker and LaGuardia and who's sitting there by himself at an outdoor cafe, but Russell Simmons. So my mind goes, I go into overdrive and I say to myself, this is your moment. You better talk your ass off. Like, you know, and because, and so he knew Mike because London Records used to distribute Def Jam before they did the deal with Columbia.
Right.
So Russell invited us to sit down. He was waiting for Rick. So I start talking I'm like a mile a minute about this record, that producer, you know, as much as I could. It was just bleh out of my mouth, you know, and Russell looks at me, you know, and he kind of looks at me and he says, how do you know so much about black music? I was like, I just do. And I, you know, and he said, what do you do? I said, I'm in school. But, you know, I'm trying to get this internship at Columbia Records. And he said, well, I can, you know, I'll put in a good word for you. I was like, I appreciate that. You know, he said, you know, if I could hire somebody at my company, I would hire you. I was like,
he was saying
really
that
when he was saying that a year before I started working there. So that was a long story as to how I ended up interning at Columbia Records.
Wow. And so what did you do while you were there?
I stuffed envelopes. It was really awful. They put me in the dance music department in promo, in the promo department. And it was just, I don't know if you saw the show Vinyl.
I don't need a hit, guys. I need a Nasty Bits song.
Go around the world with a woman like you.
Are you promoting me?
No, there's no promotion.
I found these guys. I brought them to you. How the fuck do I get ahead?
Around the world with a woman like you.
I want to fix this.
Those guys still worked in the record business, you know, because we're talking 1986.
'70s.
Yeah, we're talking, I mean, because if they had started in 76, for instance, it was only be 10 years into their tenure, you know, so, and they were still there and they were gross.
Right. And I'm sure, especially to a 19-year-old
woman. Yeah, exactly. It wasn't very pleasant.
Wow. Were any of them there when you came back? You know, five
yeah,
years later.
Some of them. That's like, really, isn't that great? Like, haha. You know? Yeah.
Wow. So how did you get from there to Def Jam? Oh, well, you were still in college, by the way, which I found.
I was still in college.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I was still in college. I was at this point I was 20. I literally, you know, I would do my internship. I would go to class, and then I'd be out at night, like every night, every single night, at all the hip-hop spots, you know. And then how did it happen? Literally, you know, one day in April of 87, I come home from class, and there's a note on the refrigerator. It said, Rick Rubin called. So I thought it was a joke. I said to my roommate, you know, he said, no, it sounded for real. You know, so I go to the phone and I dial the number and Rick, I know you, he has a weird kind of way of talking, like, hello, you know, and he just said, you know, how impressed everybody was at Columbia with me, and that Russell, you know, really likes me, and they think you're smart, and we're trying to do this thing with publishing, and we think, you know, you would be really good working with us. I said, okay. You know, I'm in a daze. He said, do you want to know how much you're going to make? And I said, okay. You know, because I'm thinking to myself, like, I'll pay you, you know.
Right.
So he said, $18,000. I said, done. You know, I mean, basically, I was still living off of my parents, you know, so that was a good thing. And I said, well, I have to finish, you know, I have to finish the semester, you know. And he said, no problem. I said, how about June 1st? He said, no problem. And that was how I got offered a job at Def Jam.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so when you get there, sort of paint us a picture. What's the environment like there?
Oh, it's amazing. We were on 298 Elizabeth Street. You had two floors. The first floor was Rush Management.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the more active floor. It's where reception was, where all kinds of people would come in off the street, which, you know, we ended up having to get security. And you can imagine, you know, because in that building was hip hop. Every artist was either on Def Jam or managed by Rush.
Yeah.
So we at Def Jam were upstairs on the second floor in a space that's probably about as big as this kitchen that I'm looking at right now. That's kind of how big it was. And there were four desks and there were five of us, I guess. Mm-hmm. And shout them out. It was Bill Stephanie, Lindsay Williams, George Solmers, Dave Funkenklein, and me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the five.
For more information about Faith, Bill, Lindsay, George, Dave, and the early years of Def Jam, check out Stacey Guaraseva's book, Def Jam, Inc., Russell Simmons, Rick Rubin, and the extraordinary story of the world's most influential record label.
It was amazing. It was the best time of my life. I kid you not. I mean, I don't think we had any idea that hip-hop would become this global phenomenon, I mean, at that time. Like, I guess we thought, you know, it was the most important thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But this was still a time, you know, where you could go to Music Factory and look at the wall and pick out every hip-hop record that's out.
Right.
You know, like, on a wall.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, and we had, like, our little clique. And we went to Latin Quarter and we went to Union Square and, you know, some of us went to Rooftop, some of us did not. So, you know, it was an amazing time. It really was. And the funny part is that people would come from around the world to visit Def Jam and they'd come and they'd look at our little shitty little office and, you know, just like, wow. It all happens here.
There was that European documentary crew, were they Dutch or something, who shot a bunch of stuff?
Yeah, that sounds very familiar.
Yeah. I have an appointment with Russell Simmons. Can I call you?
Okay, sure.
Our first artist was Curtis Blow. We currently represent like 40 artists. Including Curtis Blow, Houdini, LL Cool J, the Beastie Boys, Run DMC, of course, Davey D, Spider D, Sparky D, mm-hmm. a long list.
So a part of your job there, I think, was just organization, right?
Yeah, it was a lot of that. You know, basically the person who was kind of tasked with doing, you know, the legal and, you know, administrative stuff was... One day, Rick called me up. Rick lived upstairs. He lived mm-hmm. on the third floor. And he said, you know, I'm going to fire this person and you're going to take his job. I said, okay. So that involves sitting with a lot of lawyers and, you know, and doing stuff like visiting ASCAP and BMI and figuring out what they did and getting all the artists signed up, you know, there, you know, submitting copyright forms, setting up a PO system for the studio because that used to bleed a lot of money out of the company. So yeah, a lot of it was administrative work.
What's crazier to think is they'd been kind of running in an unorganized ad hoc way for 2 years or so before, three years or so before then.
Yes. Exactly. And, you know, and Columbia was picking up a lot of the slack, you know, because mm-hmm. Columbia was a distributor and, you know, and that was the other thing I did was I was the liaison between Def Jam and Columbia. So I went to a lot of their meetings, their A&R meetings, their A&R retreat, et cetera, et cetera.
So how did you manage to finish college while doing this?
I don't know. I mean, it was, I had one more semester left. Mm-hmm. I took, it was, I'm not ashamed to admit that I had this class. What was it? The Foundation of Capitalism. Because I was in the business school. And my last elective was the Foundations of Capitalism. And it was a 3.5 hour, Wednesday nights, mm-hmm. you know, 3 or 3.5 hours. With a break in between. And I pretty much left on the break every time. I also bought my paper for the for the final. I bought my paper. Oh, God. Yeah. Well, I didn't have a lot of time to study. That was for sure.
I can imagine.
But I finished. And I was glad. I was so close to finishing. And they were really supportive of me staying in school and finishing. So, yeah. So I did. Yeah.
And so where does A&R kind of come into the picture? Because, you know, you're doing, you know, the publishing kind of administrative business stuff. Where does A&R come in?
Just from making suggestions on certain things and discussions that I would have with Russell, discussions that I would have with Rick. And because I was doing A&R admin, it just kind of morphed into being the A&R department, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it happened. And then I started working on things and I started working on the LL Cool J Mama Said Knock You Out album. And I was doing for Russell some of the R&B stuff that we had mm-hmm. there.
I noticed you have executive producer credits on some of that stuff. Orange Juice Jones
and Black Flames and stuff like that. Yeah. Didn't I do everything? Russell had an old school sensibility when it came to R&B. So,
right.
Yeah.
So for people who don't really know, what's kind of a capsule description of what A&R is? Because, you know, there's the sort of 50s model, which is I'm going to match Frank Sinatra with the right songs for this album.
Right.
And then I think other people just view it as you discover new talent playing in a dingy club somewhere and you know, sign them.
I think there's still components of that.
Mm-hmm. So what actually at the time you started doing it, what was A&R?
A&R, a lot of it in hip hop was finding the right producers for projects. Mm-hmm. That was a big part of it. And finding songs.
So it still did have some of that 40s, 50s model of matching
definitely.
Songs to singers at that time.
Yeah. It still did, mm-hmm. especially with the R&B stuff, it did.
Mm-hmm. And so with Mama Said Knock You Out, how did you push for, you know, Marley to be the main musical voice on that album?
Marley Marl produced, co-produced, or remixed every single track on LL's 1990 Don't Call It a Comeback album, Mama Said Knock You Out.
I think it was like an easy gimme after the remixes he did for Jinglin' Baby and...
It's going to me right now. We will,
it's going to come to me.
The jingling baby.
An animal that kills. I'm like a shark with blood coming out the gills. You can never in your wildest dreams get a piece of this gangsta lean straight from Queens.
The jingling baby is, you know,
was
the linchpin in all of this.
So were there people objecting who kind of wanted a more sort of multi-producer thing?
I think, yeah, it was the idea, you know, there's so many other producers that he could have been working with. So
sure.
There was that.
Right.
Yeah.
So as early as like 88, there were big splits and probably earlier, you know, maybe even when you started, there were kind of big splits between the two sort of founding people at Def Jam, between mm-hmm. Rick and Russell. And so sometime in 1988, Rick says, hey, I'm going to LA for, I don't know if he said like a day or a few weeks or whatever.
Yeah, he never came back. It was the strangest experience.
Wow. When did you realize that it was a permanent move? month three or something?
Yeah, like, yeah, basically, yeah. Like, he's really, it's like, you know, the dad who goes out to buy milk and never comes back. It was kind of felt like that, you know, and I definitely felt the loss of him. I think everybody did. I mean, he was the brains behind Public Enemy and LL Cool J and Slick Rick and LL, you know, he was the guy.
How did stuff change when he left New York?
The Beastie Boys left Def Jam. Mm-hmm. I guess that was soon after, yes.
Rubin left Def Jam in 1988, and the Beasties left the label just before, at the end of 1987.
Yeah, so there was some defections from the label. I don't know. I think ultimately, you know, if you go forward a little bit, it created a void for somebody to take over the label. So by 91, Russell was, you know, definitely into kind of other things, and Fat Farm and modeling agency that he talked about and other things that he wanted to do. So he kind of pulled himself away from the label, and that created a vacuum, you know, or a void, I should say, of leadership. And that's when Lior kind of stepped in to run Def Jam.
Right. One other project you worked on while you were there, that was recorded under kind of unique circumstances, let's say, was Slick Rick's second album.
Yeah, that was really interesting. We were in somewhere near Rye, New York, as I recall, and found a studio there. He was out on $1 million bond so that he could finish his second album. And so basically, you know, I went up there, I stayed there, and he was under, there were armed guards around him constantly, like outside of his room.
And to be clear, these were armed guards that Def Jam, who had paid the bond,
that's right,
put up so that they wouldn't lose their $1 million.
Their $1 million, exactly.
Love it on me. Well, I'ma tell you a story and I come out bluntly. Want an ugly child, ain't nobody would want me. I used to walk around and get upset and upset.
In 1989, Slick Rick's mother hired his cousin, Mark Plummer, as his bodyguard. After Plummer tried several times to extort money from him, Rick fired him. Plummer, not appreciating the severance package, tried several times to rob Rick and even threatened to kill both the rapper and his mom. After finding bullet holes in his front door, Rick bought guns for protection. On July 3rd, 1990, he spotted Plummer in his neighborhood and fired four shots. Plummer and a passerby were both shot, however, neither fatally. Rick was charged shortly thereafter. After being bailed out by Russell Simmons, Rick recorded his second album, The Ruler's Back, released in 1991. Despite peaking at number 29 on the Billboard 100, the album received mixed reviews and wasn't as commercially successful as his debut. Rick eventually pleaded guilty to two counts of attempted murder and other charges, including assault, use of a firearm, and criminal possession of a weapon. The rapper called it an act of self-defense. He spent 5 years in prison, two for the then second-degree attempted murder charges he received for the shooting, and three for his struggle with the Immigration and Naturalization Services over his residency in the U.S. as he was a U.K. citizen. He was paroled from prison in 1997 and later given a full pardon by New York Governor David Paterson in 2008 and received his American citizenship in 2016.
And I just kept thinking, this is a terrible way to make a record.
Right.
Because he knows he's going back to jail. Like, how do you...
Right.
You know, how creative can you be?
Yeah. Was Columbia trying to poach a lot of Def Jam talent at that time? Was it just you?
I think it was just me. I mean, because I was there so much. Mm-hmm. So, because I was there so much, they would say to me, you know, if you ever think of making a move, you know, come work with us. And then I had an altercation with somebody and I just decided it was time to go. Mm-hmm. And I basically picked up the phone and, you know, and called Donnie Einer at Columbia and just said, you know, I'm ready to make my move now.
Wow.
Yeah.
And actually, one other thing about sort of toward the end of your time at Def Jam that I wanted to ask about was you were there sort of during the whole dust up over Public Enemy.
Yes.
You know, Professor Griff.
Yeah.
Rick Richard, Professor Griff Griffin was Public Enemy's road manager and minister of information. In March 1989, he gave an interview to the Washington Times, a notoriously right-wing newspaper owned by the messianic Christian sect, the Universal Life Church, also known as the Moonies. Griff made several anti-Semitic statements, including most famously, "Jews are responsible for the majority of the wickedness in the world." After some vacillation by Public Enemy leader Chuck D, and even a temporary disbanding of the group, Griff was kicked out, though he rejoined some years later.
What was that like from your perspective?
It was upsetting. I mean, I'm Jewish, so, you know, and I was close with Griff, you know, and I tried to have a talk with him. You know, it was disheartening, you know, and it was such a distraction from them and what they represented and, you know, to have this kind of, you know, controversy swirling around them mm-hmm. was, you know, it, I think it made me sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. It made me sad because it just seemed so, such a, not worthless, what's the word I'm looking for? Beneath them.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you, you know, you moved to Columbia.
Yes.
Right.
In 91.
91. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously you've talked a lot about the details of discovering, you know,
Nasir.
Yeah. Young Nasir.
Nasty Nas.
Right.
Yeah.
But all of New York, if not all of the, you know, the entire music industry was looking for this kid.
Yeah.
I assume no one really knew much about him, who was on Live at the Barbecue.
That's right.
Verbal assassin, my architect pleases. When I was 12, I went to hell for snuffing Jesus. Nasty Nas is a rebel to America. Police murderer, I'm causing hysteria. My troops roll up with a strange force. I was trapped in a cage and lit out by the main source.
How did it end up being you?
I just was very persistent and I put the word out. This is when I was still at Def Jam. So I left Def Jam in August of 91 and started in September at Columbia, or I left in July and I started. So whatever it was, I had a whole month off. Mm-hmm. And apparently during that time, Nas and Large Professor had come to Def Jam because it was Def Jam, right?
Yeah.
So to look for me, but I wasn't there anymore. So, you know, we kind of missed each other there. And I mean, the bottom line is that I, you know, was persistent and I let it be known that I wanted this kid. And so the day that Search walked into my office and said, I found him.
Yeah.
Here's his demo. I was 2 weeks into my job and, you know, and that was it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that demo, you know, that the songs on it have since, you know, made their way into the into the wider world.
Yeah.
Nickname the killer clan, super killer man. If it's still a gram, I shake my left hand and not do a minute on a rock. Cause if I do a minute on a rock, the jury's getting knocked. Hard to tell. I excel and prevail. The mic comes in contact with the third rail. My raps react, they attack the whack just like a maniac. With this, see, I'm a brainiac. I'll call you tattoo, you never come more.
What did you hear in them?
His lyrics. My God, his lyrics. I mean, call you tattoo, you'll never come off. It was just like, you know, it was just, it was, he had, it was a two-song demo, Ain't Hard to Tell, with different lyrics and Just Another Day in Projects, which apparently I think Russell had heard and basically said he sounds like G-Rap.
Ah, that's the infamous song.
G-Rap, and which he did a little bit. You know?
Sure. I mean, he was a kid.
But who would, G-Rap was, you know, fucking G-Rap.
Right.
Who didn't love G-Rap? It was just his lyrics, and I kept that cassette, which I have somewhere in my Walkman for like days, just listening over and over and playing it for everybody, you know? His lyrical skills were beyond what I had ever heard.
When did you discover that, you know, Wild Style was kind of a big bonding thing between you two?
Oh, well, first time he came up to see me at Columbia, he was kind of very shy and he had his bubble goose on, you know, he had a hoodie on. He wasn't really making much eye contact with me. And you know, and I'm like trying to like, you know, loosen up the situation a little bit, you know. Yeah. And then he like, he looks up at me one point. He's like, because I'm talking about hip hop and this and that and this producer, that producer, this artist, that artist, you know. And he looks at me and he's like, so you're like that lady from Wild Style.
Hey, ain't you that lady reporter looking for the graffiti artist by the Dixon?
Yeah, I'm looking for the graffiti artist.
We are all graffiti artists.
Well, let's go to the Dixon.
And he laughs and I laugh. I'm like, not exactly.
Right.
But, you know, and that's how we started talking about Wild Style. For the record, if you don't know what I look nothing like that woman, just so you know. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right,
you
right.
Know, you I know, don't look but, like...
Nothing wrong with Patty Esser,
Patty
no
Esser.
Shots.
Yeah. No. I'm just... It's just that we're quite different.
Right.
Yes.
And that is your tape we can hear on Genesis.
That's correct.
You're just sitting at home doing this shit, and you should be honoring a medal for this. Stop fucking around and be a man. There ain't nothing out here for you. Oh, yes, there is. This.
Yes, that I never got back. I lent him two VHS tapes. I lent him Wild Style, and I lent him... What did I give him? Goodfellas, I think? Mm-hmm. Goodfellas. Never got him back. It's okay. You know. Yeah. Don't need them now.
Right.
Now I have a DVD of Wild Style, so, yeah. You know.
One of the things people love about Illmatic mm-hmm. is that it's so short.
Yeah.
But it wasn't intended to be that way.
No, it wasn't intended to be that way at all. It was intended to have at least three more songs on it. The problem was, there's a couple problems. One is that it took 2 years to make Illmatic. Mm-hmm. And then the other was that there were... You know, many leaks, kind of like the Trump administration. There were many leaks, and the album got out there as a bootleg
right.
copy, and it was everywhere. And I mean, overseas everywhere.
Wow. People so it wasn't just copies. Kind of like a few tastemakers.
No. Point, it was yeah. widespread. It was everywhere. And we had to rush the album out. There was no way, given that it took 2 years to make 9 songs, kind of like
right.
to make 3 more would have taken a good long time, you right. know? And in the end, I think it's a perfect album because of its, you know, kind of how short it is.
Yeah.
Because there's no filler on there. Every song is impactful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When did you realize, you know, I'm sure you, you know, having seen every step of the way, I'm sure you realized mm-hmm. it was great, but when did you realize that
it was
you
genius.
Know, it was genius, and that the wider world was going to see that it was
genius.
Great, yeah,
yeah. Well, I knew it. You know, I was hearing the songs as they were being made. I was
in all their versions. You can,
yeah, find, yeah. yeah, exactly. And I think I really knew. And I've told this story before, but there was one night we were at the studio, and he did not show up. He had left his lyric book. In the studio, and I started reading it, and I just was like, this guy is a fucking genius. And if it takes 2 years to make the record, right. takes 2 years to make the record. If he's not feeling it, he's not feeling it. It's all good.
Yeah.
I kind of let it go at that point, you know, and figured whatever was going to happen was going to happen.
Yeah.
So during your time at Columbia, I know you tried to kind of build up an identity for them
yeah.
in hip hop outside of Rough House, outside of the other stuff they
right.
distributed. And you tried with, you know, not just Nas, but, you know, Curious, Jamalski, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you can sort of put it into words, what was your vision for the rap side of Columbia?
Well, I had a campaign, which we called No Doubt.
You can see a photo of a 12-inch slip map for the campaign, as well as a track list for its compilation CD in the show notes for this episode.
And it was Nas, Big L, Fugees, Curious, Jamalski, probably forgetting somebody. You know, my vision was to just, you know, have it operate like its own little label,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that that was the vision for Columbia as well, you know? Why have these So Def and Rough House, you know, when we can have it right here in-house,
mm-hmm.
you know?
What parts of that do you think worked and what didn't?
I think that, you know, you can't really act as an indie label when you're in such a massive major label system.
Right.
You just can't get things out as fast. And there's just a little too much kind of, I don't know what you call it, red tape or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you may not have people who are, you know, we didn't have separate release. Well, we did. We had one separate promo person and we had one separate product manager who worked all this stuff. But at the end of the day, it was still a major, major, massive label.
Mm-hmm. With all the expectations of sales and stuff.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
What about Big L? How did he first get on your radar?
Well, Kurt Woodley was the person who brought Big L in, mm-hmm. and then left kind of soon after. So I became, you know, the de facto A&R person. I loved Big L. I thought that he was really special. I think, though, that there was like Nas mania mm-hmm. in the building.
I was going to say it took a little while between when Al kind of was brought in and when that first,
the first album came out. Exactly.
Big L signed to Columbia Records in 1993. His debut album, Lifestyles of the Poor and Dangerous, came out in March 1995.
I think he got a little lost in the shuffle with what was going on, you know, with Nas and stuff. It was mm-hmm. kind of. And I wonder now if he felt that at the time, you know, and his project took so long to come out.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you remember about him passing?
I was at Jive at that point and I got a call from a police officer and they told me what had happened and asked me questions and if I knew, you know, anything that would help them in their investigation. And at that point, you know, this was 99, right? Mm-hmm. I hadn't really worked with him for a few years, but I was pretty torn up about that because he didn't deserve that. He was like a good guy. He really was. Yeah. And I knew that whatever had happened wasn't necessarily intended for him.
On February 15th, 1999, Big L was killed in Harlem after being shot 9 times in the face and chest in a drive-by. Ultimately, one of Big L's childhood friends, Gerard Woodley, was arrested 3 months later for the crime. While the NYPD believe it may have been retaliation for something Big L's brother did or Woodley believed that he had done, Woodley was later controversially released and the case remained unsolved. On June 24th, 2016, Woodley was shot in the head just down the block from where he was alleged to have shot Big L and later died in Harlem Hospital.
You know. Yeah.
You worked obviously closely with Nas on Illmatic, mm-hmm. but not really on the second projects after that. Yeah, on the second album. What were some of the dynamics behind that?
Well, he had a new manager named Steve Stout, who I introduced him to and introduced him to Trackmasters.
The production duo of Jean-Claude Polk Olivier and Samuel Tone Barnes, collectively known as the Trackmasters, produced or co-produced 8 of the 14 songs on Nas's sophomore album, It Was Written.
You know, at first, Nas was hesitant to want to work with them, and it was just the direction that they were going in I wasn't happy with. Mm-hmm. I felt that he should stay true to who he was and what Illmatic was and, you know, and not try to be all glossy and, you know. Everybody flashing, fashion, designer clothes, lacing your click up with diamond rolls. Your people holding dough, no parole, no rubbers. Going raw, imagine law with no undercovers. Just some thoughts for the mind. I take a glimpse into time, watch the blimp read, the world is mine. If I rule the world, imagine that. But we were headed into a different era in hip hop. I recognize that. Mm-hmm. You know, 94 and 96 were much different years,
right?
In terms of what was popular and what's, you know, and stylistically what was going on. Mm-hmm. And that was the conversation that I had with Nas. And I basically said, you know, if you stay true to who you are, you'll have a career another 10 years, you know, which seemed like a long time at the time.
Sure.
You know, when you're in your 20s,
who can imagine
when you're
that?
In your 20s, 10 years yeah. is like a really long time, you know? So we had a difference of opinion on the direction of the album. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, and so then, you know, you end up moving to Jive. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I actually wanted to ask about your time with Jive wasn't hip hop at all, but was R&B. You signed Jamiroquai while you were there.
No, I signed Jameer Quay to Columbia.
Oh, that was at Columbia.
Yeah, that was very early. That was the second act I signed.
Oh, right. That must have been 91, 92.
91. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Got my timeline a little screwed up. How did that happen?
Acid Jazz. He was signed to Acid Jazz at the time, mm-hmm. and a guy named Kieran Hurley, who was A&R at Acid Jazz, brought me a cassette, and it was one song. It was called "When You Gonna Learn." I thought it was a woman singing. Couldn't really tell. But it was one of the best things I'd ever heard. And I basically flew to London. This is 2 weeks before Christmas. I flew to London to meet him and, you know, pretty much signed him on the spot.
Amazing. Mm. Yeah. So while you were at Jive, one of the things you did was work on some of Tupac's sort of early posthumous recordings.
Mm-hmm.
Ones in heaven gotta get them. I was
raised a little. Faith oversaw the recording of Tupac's first posthumous single, "I Wonder If Heaven Got a Ghetto," and other songs on the 1997 album "Are You Still Down? Remember Me."
What was that like? Because that was, I mean, now, you know, there's a zillion posthumous things and remixes and mashups.
Yeah, and this was fairly early.
Yeah,
so
this was right after.
Right after. So this was really good stuff that we had.
Yeah.
And Afeni was very involved in the making of the album. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was just kind of a curating thing, getting mixes done. You know, it was pretty. It wasn't like I was A&Ring in the sense that I was picking out which songs to use. It was kind of like it was already decided which songs were going to be used. And so I just did, again, some of the admin work on it.
Right.
Going back to my roots. Yeah.
And while you were at Jive, who did you sign? Who did you kind of attempt to sign that maybe it didn't?
I signed, you know, a couple things. Basically, what I was tasked with when I got there was to kind of be the hip-hop A&R person. Mm-hmm. So that meant working with UGK, Too Short, E-40, Spice One, KRS-One, Tribe. I mean, it was like, it was a pretty hefty roster already. So I signed a couple things. I signed this girl who would have been a superstar, named Jane Blaze. She was kind of like Eve before Eve was Eve. Rap with magnums like Tom Selleck. Spray your pumpkin. They don't call me Jane Blaze for nothing. I'll save your bluffing for one of the model chicks. Dropping non modest hits. The proof, I'm the hottest bitch. Go out like an Islamic clique. I'm on some Jeffrey Dahmer uncut drama like when a llama spit. Release hammers to protect my. And she had everybody like on her, like wanting to work with her, wanting to do stuff with her. We had, a guy named Curtis Jackson writing her lyrics, helping her write her lyrics. So that was how I met 50.
Wow.
And Sean Money was doing the production and it was really good. It's just that she felt that she wasn't ready for prime time. And so it just never kind of happened. Mm-hmm. I also signed this guy named Casino, who was part of the Lox crew. Part of the Rough Riders crew. Get your name. Don't you see my chain? Got a lot of ice. And she like, yeah, that's nice. You casino, right? And I said, yeah, that's right. That was you that I seen on TV last night. I said, yeah. She said, I'm sorry, you ain't my type. I want a chick I can holler at. That was kind of it. And the rest of it was doing maintenance with the acts that were already there.
Right.
Yeah.
Jive's maybe their biggest sort of legacy artist on the R&B side is R. Kelly. Did you ever do stuff with him?
Again, kind of like what I did with Tupac is what I did with R with the double album.
Mm-hmm.
Faith is referring here to R. Kelly's 1998 double album R, which featured "I'm Your Angel" and "I Believe I Can Fly."
In terms of just those kinds of things, you know, curating, facilitating that stuff. And that was kind of the only thing that I did with R. Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And to take it back for 1 minute, you know, we've had a couple Wu-Tang related people on the show over the years. You wanted to sign them when you were at Columbia.
Right.
What happened?
Can I speak frankly?
Sure,
I was told that they were shit.
Wow. By someone higher else
up,
at the...
By a higher up. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to name names?
Do I have to? I'm going to get in trouble. The president of the label.
Wow.
I'll just say that.
Okay.
That's the sound of the beast. I'm a Columbia record slave, so get paid. Control your own.
Interestingly, in a 2014 interview with NPR linked in the show notes, Faith also said the same person wanted her to drop Nas. We can't be exactly sure who Faith is referring to, but here's what we do know. Don Einar was appointed president of Columbia Records in April of 1989, definitely had that title in 1990, and became president of Sony Music US in April 2003, although Einar stepped down as chairman of Sony Music Label Group in 2006. Sony, of course, is the parent company of Columbia. While Einar might have regretted the Nas and Wu decisions, he also was just recently accused this week of using the N-word by John Mellencamp during a Howard Stern interview. Mellencamp said this was his motivation to leave the label. On top of that, the late George Michael's fight to leave Columbia was also inspired by Einar, who accused Einar of calling him a faggot, an accusation Einar denied. Suffice it to say, smoke yes, fire Sean and I are pretty sure.
Yeah, that was when Protect Your Neck was bubbling.
Mm-hmm.
I had every intention of signing them. I have a great thing that I saved of a memo of a message from my assistant that said Old Dirty Bastard called, which I have saved to this day. So, yeah, that was unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking kind of through your albums you've been credited on and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of them was a Miles Davis record. Was
yes.
Doobop toward the, if not maybe his last album.
His last album.
His last album. What did you do with that?
Basically, I put him together with Easy Mo B.
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of how it came about.
Easy Mo B produced the entirety of Miles Davis's Grammy-winning album, Doobop. The album was released in 1992, just over a year after Davis's death.
I got to see Miles, talk to him. He was kind of a lech, but, you know, kind of figured that would be the case.
Mm-hmm.
He said to me, he called me at the office once, and he said, it was his 70th birthday that we just had, or 70 or something. And I went at Tavern on the Green, and I went to his birthday party, and he called me the next day, and he's like, "You feel somebody's hand on your ass last night?" And I was like, "Whoa." He's like, "That was me." I was like, "Okay, cool." Yeah. I don't want to denigrate his name like that, but yeah, that was kind of funny.
Right.
And that was it. And he decided, you know, because he was always trying new things. I thought, you know, I use him as an example to other artists that he never stuck, you know, he never lived in the past. He was always trying new things and pushing the envelope. And right. Yeah.
One final thing about your time at Jive is in, I think it was 94. You had a meeting mm-hmm. with a childhood idol of yours, with Teddy Pendergrass.
Yeah, this is when I was still at Columbia.
Oh, that was still at Columbia?
Yeah, I stayed at Columbia till 96.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I met Teddy Pendergrass.
Yeah, what was that like?
I was so nervous. I was really nervous because I was such a huge Teddy fan from the time I was like a teenager.
Right, you wrote a wonderful essay about him after he passed.
Thank you.
We'll have a link to Faith's essay, What Teddy Meant to Me, or Reflections of a White Girl Misunderstood, in the show notes for this episode.
Yeah
that was a tough one for me. It was it was him and what he represented in terms of part of my childhood and mm-hmm. having his pictures on my wall when I was 13 and stuff like that, right. You know? Yeah.
Right. And he was obviously the most well-known voice of what's sometimes called Philly soul.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. And I'm still a Philly girl at heart.
Right.
I grew up there. I mean, I may not have lived there since I was 17, but it still informed my musical tastes. And
right. And yeah. plays into your career now.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's my career now. That's right.
Yeah. So now you are at Reservoir publishing,
yes.
You know, boutique publishing company.
Yes, I am.
And part of what you do there is going to the catalogs of old labels and, you know, trying to bring them new life. And
that's right.
One of those was Philly Groove.
That's right.
So mm-hmm. what is... people know, you know, I think the Philly soul sound, and mm-hmm. they know sort of the big players, the kind of Gamble and Huff stuff. What is Philly Groove?
Philly Groove was a small label. It started in 1968. They had, their biggest act was the Delphonics,
mm-hmm.
which everybody knows.
Right.
Who were signed in 68. So Philly, but what a lot of people don't know about Philly Groove is beyond the Delphonics and a group called First Choice that they had that did very well. The label kind of shuttered in 74. So that was the end of the label. But I have discovered in going through tapes that I found all of these other acts that were signed there that are genius. A group called the Coupe de Villes. A group called the Nat Turner Rebellion. Just how it really is. Put your head in my head. Just really amazing soul stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That we're working on actually putting out for the first time.
I was going to say a lot. I know, you know, some of them maybe never had stuff released. Some of them, I think Nat Turner Rebellion had like a single or two.
Right, exactly.
That actually only ever came out.
Yeah.
But there's more stuff recorded.
There's more stuff recorded. There's a whole album recorded.
Wow.
Yeah. So 13 songs. There's one surviving member, Joe Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to get this out while he's still with us, you know?
Definitely. So what else on the contemporary side, you're still working in hip hop at Reservoir. What's going on there?
Well, I signed 2 Chainz. I signed Joey Badass. I signed Just Blaze recently, as mm-hmm. you know.
Yes.
And I just, as of last week, signed 2 of the 3 Migos. So yes, still doing hip hop stuff.
That's amazing. And so what's the 15-30 second capsule description of what a publishing deal is for our audience?
A publishing deal is really important because it's really how artists get paid.
Mm-hmm.
Songwriters get paid. You get paid on your mechanicals for sales. You get paid off streaming. You get paid off of YouTube. It's really, as record sales kind of go down, publishing still remains steady.
Mm-hmm.
And I think touring and publishing are like 2 of the biggest sources of income for artists these days. And we help them by doing the admin for them and registering everything and making sure they're paid around the world. And but we also do sync placements. So we place their music in film and TV and commercials and video games, which is a big source of revenue. And that's a lot of what we do.
And so, as far as your career goes, when did you leave Jive?
I left Jive in 2000.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what was next after that? Because I know that Reservoir is relatively recent.
Reservoir is 6 years now. Well, I worked for Mariah Carey's label for 3 years. That was interesting.
Wow. What was that like?
It wasn't like much, because she didn't want to sign very much. So a lot of stuff that I brought in, she wasn't, you know, interested in signing.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately never signed anything to the label. So it's kind of a vanity project that never really took off.
What was the name of the label?
Monarch.
Oh, okay. Makes sense.
Yeah. It's a butterfly.
Yeah.
So I did a couple interesting things over there. Randomly God, this is an interesting story. I happened to be in the airport in a bookstore and I saw the book Wifey by Judy Blume. That was a book that when we were kids, you know, it was like dirty, like, you know, mm-hmm. it was like the grown-up Judy Blume that you weren't supposed to read. At any rate, I thought this would make a great movie. Maybe Mariah'd be interested in something like that, you know? So I found her agent, Judy Blume, and then one day Judy Blume just called me, which was crazy.
Oh.
And so we met a few times about that. It just never got off the ground. So,
wow, the Mariah Carey movie that could have been.
Wow. Yeah. And then I took 2 years off from the business.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten married. And that was not the reason. It just coincided. It wasn't like I decided I'm going to give all this up because I got married.
Mm-hmm.
I decided, this was 2005, I decided that I needed a break.
Mm-hmm.
I had been in the music business on and off from the time I was 16.
Right.
And I'm in my late 30s and I was just burnt out. And So I decided to take 2 years off.
Mm-hmm. And some of that time was in Pittsburgh, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Well, what was it like leaving New York for the first time?
I thought it would be great. Like at the time, it didn't, you know, at the time, you know, I'm married, I'm in love. My husband had a chance to buy a practice in Pittsburgh and he's a chiropractor. And, you know, I was like, it'd be fine. It'd be great. You know, Pittsburgh's cool. Like they have a lot of, you know, they're into the arts there. It's well supported there. Right. And, you know, it seemed like a cool little place. You know, I just didn't realize that living there was going to be actually living there. Then 2007 rolls around and my friend and her husband started a publishing company and they asked me to be a part of it. I said, I really don't know that much about, you know, I know the little that I knew from being at Def Jam, but I didn't know the ins and outs like that. And they said, well, we want you to do creative because you're creative and and so that was kind of how I started and getting into publishing at that point. And then I moved back to New York. Yeah, I had a little break, but I needed to come back.
Nice.
Yeah.
Any other projects you have going on now other than?
Another thing that I just brought in was the catalog of Willie Mitchell.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So for people who don't know, that's the guy who kind of discovered and shaped and wrote and produced Al Green.
Al Green, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's amazing because I look at our roster, you know, look at our songs now. It's like, Let's Stay Together. You know, it's crazy. And we're going to stay involved with them and turn his studio. They're having the 60th anniversary of his studio. And we're going to be involved in this. Keith Richards is doing the show and all this stuff. So we're doing like ongoing participation with them.
And, you know, you came into hip hop at a time before it was popular culture, you know, mm-hmm. essentially the popular culture. The way it is now, I know you remember it from its beginnings as a teenager, but you've been working in it professionally since, you know.
Yeah, 30 years.
Since the time you had to really fight you know, radio didn't want anything to do with it.
Right.
You know, by and large, the popular music business. Mm-hmm. Around, you know, the early 90s, stuff started changing. It was got a little more acceptable. There were crossover acts in a way there sort of hadn't been
mm-hmm.
before. What was that change like for you? What, as someone who was on the inside at that point, what did you see changing around the time of the first kind of big crossover act?
Like Tone Loc and Young MC and stuff like
that?
Yeah.
And then even, you know, even on a bigger stage, it kind of like Hammer, you know, 10 times.
Oh, God.
Stuff.
Yeah. You know, I was a purist. I was deeply committed to the culture. You know, for me, the real commercial stuff was just that. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't love it. It was definitely a change. You definitely felt the shift. Kind of like the way in 95, when I felt the shift from the East Coast and the West Coast rift. And that was the time, I mean, I'm going a little ahead, but that was the time where I knew we had crossed this line and hip hop would never be the same after that.
How do you mean?
It got real ugly, you know. And you could feel it, you know, you could feel this thing that Suge had kind of, you know, he dropped this bomb on people and you could feel that any unity that there may have been between the East and the West was done. It was done.
You know, I know when you first moved to New York,
mm-hmm.
you know, we just had Paradise Gray here. Not long ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which got me thinking about, you know, New York nightlife and kind mm-hmm. of the late 80s, like, you know, into sort of the early 90s. What were some of your favorite spots in that era?
My two favorite spots were Latin Quarter
mm-hmm.
and Union Square.
Okay.
Latin Quarter, because they always had the best shows early on, Public Enemy's first show, and they were always early on the live shows. And just because it was, oh my God, it was so great. I mean, you know, because you're so young and you're so immersed in hip hop and you're a small clique of people.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and the world too. The world was good. Thursday nights. That you know, I say this to the youngsters, that our social network was really a social network. Like, we, if we wanted to hang out with each other or talk to each other, we had to see each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have the internet. Which sounds so crazy now, but I mean, you know how we met up at the clubs or right. we met up at the record stores. You know, that's how we stayed in touch with each other.
Yeah. I mean, I still can't imagine that you had to brave Times Square every week just to get
just to go to Latin Quarter. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Well, we used to spend time at. I mean, I was like a little B-girl. You know, I was in the arcades in Times Square and doing all that, running around, like doing stuff like that, like jumping turnstiles and thinking I'm cool, you know, with my big dookie earrings and my high top spot belts, you know. It was a great time. And I, you know, I think about it now and I think about how younger people perceive it kind of like the way that I, you know, perceive like what it must have been like to be coming up in the jazz era and mm-hmm. being in Birdland and doing all those things, you know, you kind of romanticize other periods of time and music and the culture. And, you know, they look at my time like that now,
mm-hmm.
you know, and want to know what was it like to be there.
Right.
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the craziest things about hip hop now is it's in this very unique place where, you know, the people who started it and the people who sort of helped it grow are around still, but mm-hmm. it is now this sort of worldwide.
It's just pop music. It's yeah. pop music.
Yeah.
It is the popular music. It is the reason that Migos has had the number one single for like a month.
Right.
You know, I mean, in the number one album now.
Yeah.
I mean, it is popular culture and there's no, I mean, you don't even think, call it hip hop. It's just music now. It just is, you know?
Could you have imagined that when you started Never. Listening to it, but you know, roller skating in back 1979.
When I was yeah. yeah, right. boy, you did your research. My goodness. No, I could never have imagined that. And I think a part of me will always romanticize the time when it wasn't like that, you mm-hmm. know, when it was really special and really, you know, kind of just this, like I said, like this small clique of people.
Mm-hmm.
We knew we were on the verge of something great. You know, we believed in it beyond everything else. You know, we believed in hip hop.
Yeah.
But I don't think at the time, you know, we could have known what it would become.
Yeah. And, you know, finally, there's one image that I've heard you talk about that I was hoping you could tell our listeners about, which is, I don't remember what the occasion was, but Def Jam and Rush had to fly somewhere.
Oh, God, to the BRE conference in New Orleans.
The BRE conference was an annual music industry event put on by Black Radio Exclusive Magazine.
We were all on one plane.
Yeah, that's it's all of hip hop was on.
All of hip hop was on that plane. Public Enemy, LL Cool J, Eric B and Rakim. I mean, anybody, everybody.
Right.
So if something had happened to that plane, hip hop as we know it would never be the same. I'm convinced of that. It was really something, you know. But that's what I mean. You know, you could charter one plane and fit every hip hop artist in onto one chartered plane.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Amazing. Well, finally, we were talking about your roller skating days
yeah.
a second ago. I know the Spoonie G and Sequence Monster Jam
yeah.
was a big song for you.
And I'd like to know what you got for me.
Well, I'm a cherry piece, sometimes I'm a plum. Sweetie sugar, baby, come on and get some of what you've been waiting for, my dear. That month by month, year by year, and that day by day, that week by week. And
that was a huge song.
Yeah, what about that one in particular?
I don't know. Well, first of all, Spoonie G is just fucking awesome. And it's so funky. And it so encapsulates like everything that was so good about early hip hop, you know? Yeah. I just love it. That beat is ridiculous.
Nice. And that yeah. sounds like a great place to end. Faith Newman, MC Fortune of 4PAC. Thank you so much for being on the Cypher.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
I first met Faith when I was reporting on a story about her current company, Reservoir, but I'd heard of her long before. I'm really grateful that we got to hear all about Illmatic, of course, but also about the wide scope of her career beyond her involvement in that legendary album. From LL to Big L, she was right in the center of so many of hip-hop's important moments in the 1990s and beyond. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoyed this show, for example, you should check out another guest who started her career at Def Jam before going on to even greater things, Lisa Cortez, on episode 92. If you use iTunes, it's incredibly important to give us a rating and a review. It helps bring more fans and attention to the show. Also, consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. Become a patron by the end of March to get access to April's file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I was told that they were shit.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He was kind of a lech, but, you know, kind of figured that would be the case.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
It was really awful.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He has a weird kind of way of talking, like, hello.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Corey Campbell.
His lyrical skills were beyond what I had ever heard.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Sorry. I can't with him. Oh, sorry.